Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. Hey, welcome to something that you will not have seen, you haven't seen anywhere else before. You're going to get the first look at some new features we've got in Service Pack 2 for Exchange 2010. This is EXL 326, what's new in Exchange, including featuring a product or something you know as GAL segmentation, or as I personally like to call it. I'll leave that one for a second. We'll come back to that one. All right, so let's get stuck in. It's GAL's gone wild. Right, here we go. So here's what we're going to cover. Here's what I'm going to cover in the next hour or so. I've got a little bit of background about Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2. Just a little bit of background about, you know, the product and the features and how we go about adding features into service packs. And then I'm going to show you four new features that we're introducing in Service Pack 2. We do have a blog planned for the product team blog that'll be coming out tomorrow. Which will announce some of these. We've already talked about some of them briefly in a couple of previous blog posts, but some of these are entirely new. You won't have seen them before, and assuming that the demo stuff does its stuff, I'm going to show you a couple of them working. So we're going to talk about these four features listed here. So before we get going, let's give you a bit of background about Service Pack 2. So the first question will be, when can I get my hands on Service Pack 2? And we're aiming for the second half of this calendar year. Sorry, you know, I've just realized I haven't told you who I am. Right? How schoolboy error is that for you? So, Greg Taylor, I'm part of the Exchange customer experience team. I work in Redmond, which you could probably tell I'm a native of the local area up there in Washington State. I've been in the product team for just over a year. Prior to that, I ran something called the MCM and MCA programs for Exchange, and prior to that, I was in consulting for a number of years. And you know, this has been, for me, as a PM of one of the features in Service Pack 2, this has been a really interesting experience for me, coming from a consulting kind of role to then actually become a PM for a feature. And it gives you a whole different kind of perspective on a product like Exchange, which is huge. And here's an example of this. Exchange has 20 million lines of code written in probably 6 or 7 different languages. And it's kind of an interesting, nerdy fact slightly, that more than half the lines of code are test code. Right? There's more lines of code for testing the code than there are for code that does stuff. Okay? It's a huge product. Well, of course, with a product that large, bugs are going to happen. The more interesting and varied the scenarios that our customers and you deploy, the more complicated and the more spaghetti-like some of these things can become, where you start making a change in one thing and you end up impacting something else. And of course, we've got one code base of Exchange now that we're using across multiple versions, in effect, of Exchange. We have the on-premises version, we have the hosting version as well, and we have our own data center kind of flavor of Exchange as well, which we're running Office 365 on. So it's kind of inevitable there's going to be some bugs. We fix a lot of bugs, okay? Some of them are bugs that you, unfortunately, feel some pain probably with. You get, you know, you get to feel that pain, and we open a bug and we fix something. But we do also fix quite a lot of stuff that you probably never get to see. So, you know, there's a lot of additional work that goes in there as well. Now, service packs are not just about bug fixes. They're also, and certainly have been over the last few years, about introducing new features. I remember back in 2003, SP1, we introduced the Active Directory connector wizard. That was a fun time, wasn't it, the ADC? And so we started introducing features like that. And since 2007 SP1, we introduced schema changes within a service pack, which I'm sure made some of you deliriously happy. Am I right? Well, guess what? We're doing it again. In SP2, there are schema changes. All right, so there are going to be some schema changes in SP2 to support some of the new features that we're introducing. We're going to probably fix, I don't know, 500-odd bugs. You know, we've probably got 100 bugs that we're trying to squeeze in now, even now, into the service pack. And depending on how some of these features that we're working on are developing, you know, we may fix more of them. We may try and, you know, our goal is to try and fix as many of them as we can, because a service pack is a great vehicle for fixing bugs rather than a roll-up. Pretty much everyone puts a service pack on their system. So when we do get a bug in case anyone's ever been interested, how do we decide whether we're going to fix that bug? We have a very well-established, and in fact in Microsoft, somewhat enviable from some of the other product teams, system for triaging our bugs. So every bug that comes in is triaged along the lines of we look at the risk to the existing code, we look at the cost, obviously, of making this change from our perspective, and the something like the applicability as well. How many customers are going to hit this? So any bug, obviously, that hits a large proportion of our customers will be scored much higher in our triage process. We'll go to the top of the queue and, you know, is definitely up for being fixed, so that would be the hope anyway. If you're trying to do something incredibly obscure and really you're the only customer, the applicability score for that kind of bug is going to be lower. So sometimes it can be a little harder to fix everything. We can't fix every bug, right? You know, with 20 million lines of code, some of it in Perl script and some of it in C and C sharp, there's a whole bunch of different languages in use there as well. It's kind of complex and difficult to do. For the features that we decide to bring into Service Pack 2, when we actually we want to add features rather than fix bugs, we go through a typical development process, which was new to me, right? One of these things, it was the PM in we kind of work in a team of three. There's a PM, a dev, and a test. And the PM writes the functional spec. So that was what I did for the address but policy feature, right? So I write a functional spec, which is, here's the scenario that we're trying to accomplish. Here's how we're going to, you know, here's how it should work. When I click here, it should do this. When I click there, it should do that. And if I try and access it like this, it should do this. The dev team then take that functional spec, and they figure out how they're going to do it in the code. Now, it's not quite kind of like, you know, throw it across the fence and let them worry about it. We do work pretty closely together. And in fact, for the address book policy feature, the dev really was the brains behind, I'm giving him the credit for sure, right? The brains behind how we were going to take this approach in solving this particular problem. But of course, I get to do the fun work of writing the spec for it. The dev team then write their estimates and their spec on how they're going to write this thing in code. And then the test team do the same, which is how are they going to test that the code the developer has written meets the functional spec that the PM has done. So we write a bunch of paperwork, right? And then we sit down and we do spec reviews with a broader team. Now, the team that are responsible for Service Pack 2 is the servicing team, which is part of the customer experience team. So the bulk of the development team are working on some other things at the moment, things which I can't obviously mention, but let's call it the next version of Exchange, just for example. And the servicing team are working on the servicing of the existing product that's in the market. So this is the team that's basically put this whole service pack together. We also have something called the TAP program, the Technology Adoption Program. And some of you, is anyone in this room part of the TAP? So they're the hands you want to try and zone in on if you're interested. Although, obviously, they shouldn't be telling you anything, but they're the guys that have probably already got these bits and have already been playing with them. So Exchange has got a long history of working with customers, partners, during the creation of the product. And we don't care what kind of three-letter acronym we want to use, right? So it's called the JDP, the RDP, the TAP. I first worked in this kind of program when I didn't work for Microsoft back as a partner, and I worked on the Exchange 2003 rapid deployment program. You know, so it's getting access to the bits early, getting them installed, and providing feedback back into Microsoft. Now, the TAP really is about customers who want to do this in production. Deploy the bits, and I want to say beta, but I've got to say beta, right, because I'm kind of funny and foreign, right? But the beta bits, they would get them into production. Now, the build that I'm going to show you later, assuming everything works, is not a production-ready build. It's what we call DF1, Dog Food 1. It's the very first set of bits that we've given out to the TAP, and it isn't often you get to see this at a sort of public event like this. But, our TAP customers are using DF1 in a lab, and as we progress through the stages of the development cycle, they'll start deploying into production. Well, deploying pre-production code into production has some risks associated. So if you're in the TAP, you kind of accept that this is one of those things. But we do give you some special love and support for doing that. You have access to basically the development team. We have a DL, we have a wiki now for this service pack as well. And when customers hit problems or partners hit problems, they send a question to the DL. And there's a good chance that the PM, the dev, or the test who worked on the feature can answer the question. And they should know how it should work, right? But it's always kind of interesting that customers always find things we didn't think of, which is always part of the fun of software, isn't it? Now, of course, part of that is that they're not just finding bugs for us, but it's handy that they do, but they're also validating that the scenarios that we dreamed up when we wrote the spec really match what our customers want. And really, that's the job of the PM to validate early on when you write that spec, you know, is this what our customers really want from the feature that we're trying to introduce. All right, so let's enough of the talking. Let's try and see if we can get something to work here. So the first feature that we've got, Outlook Mobile Access is back. All right, so, but it's not Outlook Mobile Access, it's OWA Mini. We've brought back OWA Mini. And why have we brought back OWA Mini? Well, you know, there's a segment, it's kind of interesting. Geography-wise, there are certain parts of the world where browser-based device access is still the most popular type of access. ActiveSync is not a big take-up in some of those geographical areas. Does anyone know a good geographical area where this is, you know, there's one country in particular where browser-based access is key? Nobody from Microsoft. There is a couple of T-shirts in this for anyone who wants to ask. Not India. Not China. Japan. Whomever that was at the back there, sir, you'll get yourself a T-shirt. Right. Japan, as a mobile, as a device market, they're very strong on browser-based access still. So this feature was, to a large degree, driven by the demand from that market. So what we've done is we're bringing this feature back. I'm going to show you a very quick demo. And it's all the administration in Service Pack 2 will be through the management shell rather than the management console. And it was a complete rewrite. All right, OMA, gone, history. Right? That was a separate application. And in fact, in IIS, when you looked, OMA was a VDA in its own right, or an app, rather, an app pool in its own right. So we haven't actually reused any of that. And so it's a complete rewrite from the ground up, and it's basically an HTML new app. And look, tasks. Never had that in OMA before. Whoa! Those of you that actually use tasks, I'm sure you'll be delighted to hear that. And the way we've implemented this, if you're kind of interested, is that effectively this is a view of OWA. So it's the OWA forms, it actually sits as an IIS VDA underneath the OWA virtual directory. And so in effect, it's just a view of OWA. All right? Separate view. Now, that actually gives us some kind of interesting benefits. The key benefit, probably down the bottom here, I'll start with that one. Key benefit is that it inherits from OWA, which means all the language packs that we support in OWA, we support in OWA Mini, because it's just an alternate version of the OWA interface at that stage, right? Which is kind of cool. So the way that you'll administer this is a OWA mailbox policy. Well, actually, there's two places you can administer this. You can administer this on an OWA virtual directory basis. So with the set OWA virtual directory commandlet, you can enable or disable the feature on an entire OWA virtual directory. But using an OWA mailbox policy, you can enable or disable the feature on a per-user basis. So you could have it enabled on the OWA virtual directory, but disabled for the bulk of users, only a few could get to use it, for whatever reason you might choose to do so. We support, therefore, because it's OWA and it's inheriting all these settings from OWA, we are inheriting things like if you turn off calendar in OWA because you don't want people to view their calendar when using OWA for whatever reason, then OWA Mini won't see the calendar either. So we inherit all of those settings. Now, obviously, there are some settings that are present in OWA and are not, there are some settings that are present in OWA but not present in OWA Mini. And so obviously things like IRM is a good example called out here where the feature doesn't really exist. So in effect, it's disabled, but the feature really doesn't exist at that stage. ActiveSync policies, in case anyone's interested or asking, not relevant, right? Because we're not coming through ActiveSync. These are OWA policies, OWA mailbox policies. So there's no the ActiveSync policies don't really have any impact on this feature at all. And as I said, all of these individual features can be turned on and off on a per-user basis using OWA mailbox policies, or rather you would have a multitude of policies and apply different policies to different people. And really, this is OWA minimized. So let me just give you a quick, let me see if things will work out here for me. All right, so the way that you access the OWA Mini is through a URL. I can't talk and type at the same time. It's deadly demo. It's whatever the server name is, /OWA/OMA. Now, I did ask the PM just the other day, why did he keep OMA? Because, you know, we got rid of OMA. This is OWA Mini. And it was, there was a bit of a look of, that was a good idea. Maybe we should have done that kind of thing. Right, so who knows, right? Maybe in maybe the time we ship, who knows, maybe we'll change it. So as you can see, right, I mean, I basically have a straightforward view into my particular user's mailbox. I can have a look in here. I can check in my inbox. Okay, I've got a bunch of emails I can return, straightforward. I can look at my calendar for today. Okay, exactly as you might expect before. Obviously, I'm clicking away here on a big screen browser, but you can see I've got access to pretty much everything that I've got here. There's the actual features that we ship with are still slightly in flux, but in effect, this is my OAuth mini view of my existing mailbox that works. You know, I've got access to everything I need to from a small browser-based device, and it's entirely geared towards that particular form factor. All right, OAuth mini, good? Yeah. All right, let's get terrific. All right, let's move on. Okay. Hybrid configuration wizard. Now, one slide on this, simply because there's a session later in the week where the hybrid meaning on-premises exchange connecting to Office 365 is being discussed in detail at a session on Wednesday afternoon in this room. By then, probably the aircon will have been fixed. If not, bring an ice pack. But the basic idea of this wizard came about was because have any of you ever tried to establish what we used to call rich coexistence between on-premises and Office 365? It's kind of hard, right? There's a lot of steps. There were a lot of steps involved in configuring that, and so I hear the air coming on. Right, the point of that wizard was to try and reduce that number of steps. We've done an 80% reduction in the number of steps that will be required by the administrator to establish a hybrid model of having on-premises and Office 365. Going from 49 to 6 steps, that's a pretty impressive piece of work. And that's the hybrid configuration wizard. All right, so there's still quite a lot of work going into that at the moment. So let's get into address book policies. And I'm kind of interested in that. This is the bit that I'm PM for. So address book policies, how many of you have used the white paper, one of the iterations of the white paper to do GAL segmentation? Keep your hand up if that was easy. It is if you use ADSI edit, yeah, exactly, or AD users and computers for men, as I prefer to call that application, right? So the white paper had a history, right? And we'll touch on the history in a second. But let's face it, it wasn't a particularly simple way of solving the need. So just to make sure we're all kind of all on the same page here, what is GAL segmentation? So it's a term that I find not many people can always agree on exactly what it means. So let me give you my definition, and at least we're kind of, hopefully, you'll follow along, we're on the same page here. So obviously, as you know, in Exchange, the global address list, the word global is a giveaway here, should contain all the objects. And this kind of harks back to MS Mail days, right, with the post office and a global address list and all of this kind of stuff. We're carrying a lot of this baggage, you know, in terminology and stuff forward through versions of Exchange. But by default, that GAL contained every object. And GAL segmentation was the administrative desire to split that GAL into multiple versions so that multiple people have a different view of the GAL. Whoever you are, you know, you have a different view of the GAL from somebody else. Why would you want to do such a crazy thing? Well, generally, the reasons fall into three kind of main buckets. So there's the legal and compliance reasons that, you know, trader A can't see analyst B for whatever reason, or school child A can't see school child B. So you have these various kind of, you know, regulatory reasons why people shouldn't be able to see each other. It doesn't necessarily stop them emailing each other. GAL segmentation never would do that. You'd have to maybe, you know, add to it something like transport rules or do something else. But it was more about the view of the address list. So there's a good reason. Optimization is another good reason. If your GAL contains, as some customers that we have do, 4 million objects, 4 million objects is a heck of a big GAL. And there are a heck of a lot of John Smiths in a heck of a big GAL like that. And so organizations who typically, they're part of a large institution or a government agency or something like that, they don't typically need to see the entire GAL. They really need to see a subset that relates to the organizational unit or organizational structure that they work within. So that's another good reason or another common request for this feature. The other one is hosting. Despite our advice not to use GAL segmentation for hosting, quite a lot of customers do. And I'm sure there are probably some in this room. So you don't have to put your hands up. But if you do, I might give you the. I've got some bacon flavored toothpaste in the giveaway bag for some reason, right? You can have the bacon flavored toothpaste. So hosting, you know, selling mailboxes to different organizations and having them see a totally different version of the GAL. It's another reason why people would want to do GAL segmentation. So a little bit of history. Back in 2000, there was a KB that we pulled when HMC was created. And there was nothing for 2003. But we did get a lot of support cases as continued forward, where people try to use previous versions of something to do something with a newer version. And guess what? It doesn't always work. For 2007, there was the new GAL segmentation white paper. So that was a very popular download. A lot of customers went through that. I went through that process myself when my general manager, Kevin Allison, who I think is the author of the Post Tomorrow that's coming out, stopped by my office one day and said, GAL segmentation, figure that one out, and then kind of left, right? And this is how this little bit of work for me began. And it was straightforward. You could follow it through, but it wasn't without problems, right? We will cover some of them in a second. But for 2010, when my GM comes and asks me, you know, what should we do, the first question is, well, should we just revise the white paper? Should we just update the white paper and re-release it? And if you think about, there was a major fundamental architectural change between 2007 and 10 that meant the white paper didn't work, which was CAS, RPC Client Access Service and the Address Book Service now running on CAS. So directory comes now from a service running on the CAS server, not mailbox server or direct from AD. So you had an architectural change that meant that if you tried to directly apply the 2007 white paper to 2010, what happened? It broke quite spectacularly in some cases, and you could even lock yourself out of bits of the directory, which is not a particularly good place to be in. So we decided, well, should we re-engineer the white paper, or, and this was our preference, although obviously we know it's going to take quite a bit of work, should we engineer it properly into the product? And the reason why we definitely went with let's engineer it into the product is, A, our customers clearly want this, right? There's definitely a demand, so we should try and meet the demand if we can. B, if we engineer it into the product, it gets tested properly. The white paper for 2007 was released, but if you think that every time we ever fixed a bug in Exchange, we then went back and validated it against that environment, you'd obviously be wrong. We didn't. However, when we engineer the feature in, we write that test code that I was mentioning. And so everything that we're doing in address book policies has test code associated so that we know when we do stuff, we don't break other features. And also from a CSS, customer support services perspective as well, right? Our product support guys get calls from customers who've tried to use the old white paper approach to segment the GAL and got themselves into trouble. And that's not good for the customer, and it's not good for us. So we wanted to kind of see if we could solve all these problems. How did they work, these previous solutions? Interesting to kind of look back. There were a combination of things you had to do. You had to do a bunch of ACL work. You had to put people in security groups and ACL the address lists and the GAL objects so that they couldn't see this one, but they could see that one. And it became a little bit tricky from an Exchange perspective. You know, if you had 10,000 address lists on the system, for example, let's just say that. Then every time you try to access your address list, we had to evaluate all those ALs to figure out what you have deny, allow, deny, and all the way down. So it was kind of intensive in that way. That didn't work for OWA. That approach didn't work for OWA. Well, up until SP1 for 2010, it didn't work for OWA. So with OWA, you had something else called the MS Exchange Query Based DN. And that's a property set on a user object or a mailbox object. And basically, that thing can point to one of two places. It points to a DN, which points to either an OU, that the user is the base of everything they can search below that OU, or it pointed to a specific address list that meant they could look at that specific address list. But we changed some stuff in SP1, which meant that no longer worked. That was a problem. And per user OAB assignment, this was another trick that used to be done as well. And so you'd set the OAB on a per user, which would override whatever was set on the database. So in order to sort of set this feature up using the white paper method, you had a variety of different things you had to do. And you also had to sort of put your faith in the fact that the Outlook client and the OWA client wouldn't change their behavior. Because there are certain things in Outlook where Outlook will choose the biggest gal, or the gal that I'm a member of, or there's an algorithm that helps Outlook choose a gal when there are multiple gals available. Obviously, if Outlook changes the way they do that, this feature wouldn't work either. So what was wrong with that? Well, there's a few things. I've already mentioned a couple. But one of the biggest problem really was around management complexity. Because once you start moving to a model where you've got security groups and query-based DNs and all of this kind of stuff, you've got to give up on the UI. Because the management console, new mailbox wizard, isn't going to help you because you can't set those things. So you very much have to go to a scripted model of user provisioning, right? Maybe not a problem if, you know, this is your business, right? You probably use scripts to provision everything. But for the casual, you know, what often happened, sometimes happened, I know for this for sure, which would be you have a scripted way of provisioning users, and then some new admin comes along and uses the management console, creates a new mailbox, provisions the user. That user sees every user on the system, right? Not a particularly great experience, and potentially a data loss or a data exposure problem, which you have to face as well. Another problem, I've already mentioned, was that we did things in Exchange that could break this, because we never would test against that 2007 ACL-based model. Right? It was kind of a one-off thing that was released. And we don't like breaking things. We really don't, because customers don't like it, and we don't like it. So we were kind of concerned about that. And it was a good one, that the query-based DN stuff generally meant you ended up with a very rigid OU hierarchy, the company's OU and all the sub-OUs. Well, that worked great if your companies have nothing to do with each other. But what if you're hosting or providing virtual organizations for more than one company, but they share some kind of resource, like a CEO? One user can't exist in more than one OU. So you ended up with kind of rigid model in an OU, from an OU perspective. So they were some of the problems. So how are we solving this? So we're introducing a feature called address book policies. And that will be the method by which you could achieve this Gauss segmentation as you might know it. And we've totally changed the model from one of deny and allow to one of direct assignment. So we will directly assign to the user the address list, the gal, the OAB, and the room address list that that user is able to see. And I'll show you a nice visual that will make that dead simple to understand on the next slide here, right? So, but address book policies only apply when your mailbox is on 2010 Exchange, and you're accessing Exchange through a Service Pack 2 CAS server. And the reason is that where we've made these changes are in the address book service. The address book service running on the CAS server is where Outlook's directory, OWA's directory effectively coming through there, they all come through the CAS server and through something we call the AD driver. Right? It's a kind of a common path. Directory on the middle tier was a kind of internal name that was being used back at the release of 2010. So all the directory comes through the CAS server. And if you think about it, it's fairly simple from a logic perspective. What we've basically done is we've said at the top of the address book service, we've said, is the incoming user, and we know who it is because they've authenticated, does that user have an address book policy? If so, only let them see this. If not, just do what you always did. Okay? So a picture speaks 1,000 words. So this is how an address book policy is built. Along the bottom here, I've got address list objects, multiple of address list objects, and they're all based on LDAP or OPATH filters. I've got some OAB objects. I've got some GAL objects, global address list objects. And I've got some room address list objects. Now, room address list objects are nothing different than a regular address list. It's just the filter you would use to build them would have a room type, or the object type would be a conference room. And the reason there's a room address list is in OWA on Exchange 2010 and in Outlook 2010, you have the rooms button where you can pick room resources. That's where we go straight to that address list rather than the default gal. So I build my base objects and I then group them together into something called an address book policy, which is shown up here above. Right? So I have a one or many address lists. I have one gal, one room list, and one OAB. And then I assign them to individual users. And effectively what we have here is a saved query, LDAP filter, if you like, for the scope of what this user is able to see when they query the address book. Does that make sense? Straightforward? A lot easier than allows and denies across the board, right? Direct assignment. So what kind of actions get affected by ABPs? So basically, anything that's coming through the CAS for the directory, coming through the address book service. So for example, I'm in Outlook, and I go and open up the GAL, or open up the address book. And then I click the drop-down for the address list picker. They'll all be subject to ABP. If I try and resolve a name or an alias, so if I know somebody's SMTP address or their alias, I'll type that in. I won't be able to resolve them unless they're in the scope of my address book policy. Okay? Kind of cool. If I go to the add a room, we'll go straight to the room address list specified in the policy. If I do a direct search against the GAL, or if I try and use Outlook Voice Access or ActiveSync, any of those clients I try and do a directory search, then because we know the user that's making the request, we go through that question at the top, which is, do they have an ABP? If so, filter the results based on this. And if they don't, just let them see everything. The bottom one's kind of interesting. We will also filter the members of a DL. If you open up a DL, expand a DL, we will filter the membership of a DL based on your address book policy. The scenario for this is the one with a shared CEO, and I'll show you how this works in a demo in a second. But the idea really of this is that if, let's say, I have two organizations and they share a resource, whether it be a person or some other thing, you know, I could look at their DL membership. I could then use their DL membership and look at the members of the DLs that they're a member of, and I could discover people that are outside of effectively my organization. So what we do with the DL filtering is we will only show you the users in a DL that are within the scope of your ABP, which has some consequences if you think about this, right? It means that if I open up a DL and I see 10 users, there might not be 10 users. There might be more, depending on the ABP. So this is about, I'll cover that with, but if you send an email to the DL, it will go to everyone. The visibility is affected, not the delivery. Okay? Mail tips might be lying to you, but mail tips, don't forget, you know, is a guesstimate anyway. Because mail tips will, you know, if you're using the mail tips feature and it says there are, you know, 250 people in the DL you're about to send to, MailTips doesn't count nested DLs anyway. So if you had DLs within DLs, MailTips is not going to give you an accurate count there either. MailTips is a tip, right? It's not a guarantee. But, you know, this feature is kind of interesting for one scenario, which I'll show you. So here's a couple of different scenarios. So I've got, in this case, I've got my two separate organizations. I've got my Fabricam and my Tailspin org. Now, the first thing I'm probably going to do with this is I'm going to group my users into logical units, right? And I'm going to, you know, my users and DLs from each organization, I'm going to base it on some kind of query, some kind of attribute, some kind of filter. Then the next thing I'll go and do is I'll build a bunch of address lists, which are both descriptive and contain, obviously, just those users that I want to contain within that particular scope of that particular address list. So I might have one for users and DLs, one for rooms, one for contact objects for each of those two organizations. I'll then create myself a GAL object for each. Now, a GAL is nothing more than a... In fact, a GAL is an address list, too, but it just has an additional property that says, is a GAL set to true. And in fact, at one point, I was kind of arguing maybe the GAL object should disappear entirely from Exchange and that the GAL is more of a calculated GAL. Okay? You have a quick question?
Just kind of going back to where you started. Like, now we're going back to LDAP. We want from LDAP to OPAD. Now we're going back to LDAP.
All right. So the question is, are we going back to, isn't it going backwards in time, you know, effectively using, well, arguable point, I mean, we're still talking back through AD and AD. We're using LDAP in the existing case, and we have been for years. But the query, if you think about it, the query that I make into the address book service still has to go talk to AD anyway. So even if it were an LDAP query of give me everything in the directory, it's still a query at that stage. Okay. Yeah, no, it does, absolutely. So the question is, you know, it's LDAP, OPATH, are we going back to LDAP? How you would build your address list now is not going to change. However you decide you're going to build an address list, that isn't going to change. And there's a chance you might already have these address lists anyway. You can build these address lists on anything you like. All right, so there's no hard and fast. As long as you can build a query that contains the objects, you go wild and build that query. Okay, so let me, so the gal object. So I'm going to create a gal object. And now a gal object is really the super scope of all the address lists that I would contain in the policy. The gal should be the biggest. And then I would build an OAB, and the advice here would be to build an OAB based on the gal. Now, have any of you ever tried to do that before? You probably have, and it probably didn't work, right? There's been kind of a bit of a lingering bug for a number of years in the product, where if you tried to build an OAB on a custom gal, it would be built on the default gal regardless, which was kind of a bummer. It's like, yeah, I'm accepting what you're asking me to do, but I'm going to ignore it. We've fixed that here too. So you can now build an OAB on a custom gal and have exactly the right number of objects represented in the OAB, which is good news. So then what I would do for each of these two organizations is I'd go ahead and create myself an address book policy for each organization. I'd contain, obviously, the address list, the gal, the OAB, and a room list that defined just the Fabricam objects in the Fabricam ABP, and the same for Tailspin. And then I'll go and directly assign those to the users that are contained within those organizations. Pretty straightforward, right? You build an ABP on existing objects, you assign it to users, and magic happens, you hope, assuming you built your queries right, okay? Now, the next scenario is kind of interesting. This is the one that was very hard to do with the previous model because one person couldn't exist in multiple OUs at the same time. So let's say in this scenario now, Fabricam and Tailspin, they have a common resource, the boss. He owns both organizations. He wants to be a part of both organizations. Well, he can't be in more than one OU at the same time, so the previous method of OU-based filtering was never really going to cut the mustard, really, for this particular scenario. But if, let's say, I want him to exist in both organizations, I would create his own custom ABP. And the ABP for the boss, in this case, would contain a scope of everything. He can see absolutely everybody in both organizations, and I simply accomplish that by adding all the address lists that he might want to see, and I build a gal object that's just for him. Now, in this case, I've got default gal. It could be the default gal. It might be a custom gal just for him, where company equals Fabricam or Contoso. Done. He then gets to see everybody, and I assign that directly to him. So he has a slightly different view of the gal than everybody else. Then let's say he goes one step further, and because they love him so much, because he's such a popular boss, this is a DL, right? He creates a DL, and let's call it the senior leadership DL. And he puts somebody from Fabricam and somebody from Contoso, Fabricam and Tailspin. He might put somebody from Contoso in there, but that would probably be a bit bad for the security of the company. Fabricam and Tailspin here. And he puts somebody from each of those organizations into the DL. There are now three people in the DL. Now, here's when we get into the scenario I was mentioning about DL filtering, because if somebody in Fabricam were able to browse up and see the membership, and that then allowed us to see the members of the senior leadership DL included somebody from Tailspin, then I could then browse down the Tailspin gal through member and member of, and see everybody in Tailspin, which is not really the point of what we're trying to achieve here. Quite the opposite, in fact. All right, so here's another scenario. So we can do that previous one with ABPs, and that's the one I'll show you in a moment. So here's another common scenario, and this is more of the legal one. This is one we're coming up against and we're hearing about quite a lot. And the basis of this scenario is a school where a student in one class is not allowed to see a student in another class in the address list. Okay, you can apply this to any industry, right? This could definitely happen. This is quite common in an education scenario. So you can see I have a principal, I have a couple of teachers, and I have two classes with two students. I have a number of DLs. I've got a DL for class A, which contains three members. I've got a DL for class B, which contains two members. I have a faculty DL, again with three members. And I have an everyone DL with five members in it. Everybody in it. So how I would approach this was I would take an approach like this. I build a number of address lists. I build an address list for each of the classes. So some custom attribute, perhaps, where class equals X, build an address list where it's a mailbox and attribute 1 equals this value. I build an address list that contains all the teachers, where some other attribute equals some other value, clump them together. I'd build another AL, perhaps, where all the students are included. And then I'd create an address list where all the groups are as well. I then go and build policies for each of the students. I've got certain kind of, you know, think about the, I might end up with a lot of policies. It's a complex scenario. But I have an address book policy for my student in Class A that basically enables him to see this view of the world. So he can see all the DLs. But here's what his membership looks like when he looks at the membership list in an Outlook or an OWA client. In the Class A DL, he sees all three members. When he looks at the Class B DL, he can see the Class B DL, but he can only see two members. He can see the everyone DL, whereas there are actually five members, he only sees four. And the faculty, he sees all the members of the faculty. So you see how we're able to basically scope him to people within his own class and any member of staff. That's the effective scope of his address book policy. The principal, on the other hand, has got the big scope. All the address lists without any real filtering. And as you would expect, that the membership, when he looks at the DLs, he's going to see the correct, if there is a term, the fully populated membership of each of these DLs when he looks at the view. Okay? You see how we can use that to mask and hide people? So let me show you how that works for real, assuming that this works and works well. All right, so I've got a mailbox here. I've got an exchange system and a mailbox. And the first thing I do, I've got Fred at Fabricam here. And if I go and look at Fred's gal here, you can see right now I've got a bunch of users with Contoso on them, a bunch of users with Fabricam. This guy has no address book policy assignment. So he sees everybody. So I'm going to close his Outlook client. I'm going to flick back. We'll come back to that in a second. All right, so just to show you there. So Fred could see everyone, okay? Now I switch to Exchange, and you can see I have a bunch of mailboxes and a bunch of objects sitting in Exchange. I've got a bunch of guys from Contoso, a bunch of people from Fabricam. What I want to do, too, is show you that if I go into AD, they're all in the users container because I'm a lazy administrator. I didn't bother with an OU hierarchy or any of that stuff, right? You don't need an OU hierarchy. You're probably going to do an OU hierarchy for some other reason, delegation of administration or whatever else. But the point is that this feature doesn't require it. So now if I go show you some of the new things that we've done in the UI. So I'm on the address list tab. You can see I have a bunch of address lists created. I can quickly go and look at the scope of one of these address lists. Well, when I say quickly as the management console will allow me to look. Come on, management console. There we go. Okay, and you can see I basically just have a filter here for all recipient types where custom attribute 1 equals a particular value or values that I've chosen. I have address list objects. I have gal objects. You can't manage gal objects in the management console, unfortunately, as I'm sure some of you know. And I have room address list objects, which are exactly the same as the previous address list, but they just have a type of conference room mailbox, I think it is, something like that. I have a bunch of OAB objects. I've got an OAB for Fabricam. If I look at my OAB for Fabricam, you can see that it's all grayed out. And the reason it's grayed out is that, unfortunately, the UI also won't let you pick a gal for an OAB as a source of an OAB unless it's the default gal. I'm hoping we might fix that, but not sure. Either way, you can basically create the OAB from the management shell, and then the object obviously is visible but not manageable through the management console. So here's the new thing that we've got. There's a new tab here called Address Book Policies. And this lists my address book policies. We've got a new wizard on the right here as well, the new Address Book Policy Wizard. If I look at an address book policy for Fabricam, you can basically see the elements that go to make up my Fabricam address book policy. I have my Fabricam gal, my Fabricam OAB room list, and the address list that apply to the Fabricam organization. The way I then apply this to a user, I can simply go into a user object. I go onto the mailbox settings tab. We've added a new piece of work here called the address book policy. I can simply apply an address book policy. I pick from the available address book policies. I click OK and I'm done. We've actually also added in to the new mailbox. Wizard as well. Let me see if I've got an existing user. Yep. We have this down the bottom. So I can now add an address book policy through the UI at the point of mailbox creation as well. Cancel that one. Okay. So now you can see I've got how easy it is. You agree that's pretty easy? Create a policy. The hard bit is probably creating the LDAP, the filters for the address lists. Okay. But I've got a few tips on how you might want to do that. I now flick back to my client. I'm logged in as Fred. I open up Fred's mailbox. And I go click on the address book. I now only see people in the Fabricam organization. Yes? Cool? Come on. Yeah. The only address lists he can see are the address lists that are in the scope of his policy. Okay? Now let me flick over to an OWA client for a second here as well. We'll see what this looks like from an OWA perspective. Yeah, that's fine. That was the idea. All right, so Chris has... Okay, so Chris goes and looks at his address list. Now, Chris has the Contoso ABP applied to him already. And he can only see Contoso users. He sees Chris from Contoso, Crispin from Contoso, and a bunch of people. Now, you may... The sharp, the observant amongst you may have noticed Big Boss at the top here. Big Boss is at the in both policies because he's that joint CEO that I was talking about. Now, here's what's kind of interesting. Let me look at a couple of DLs. Let me go look at the all Contoso DL, for example. So I've got Bob, the boss, and all the people from Contoso. They're all in that DL. If I look at my senior leadership DL, I see Bob and Chris. Chris is my senior leader from the Contoso org in my case. He just sees two members, okay? Let's flick back over here and see what Fred sees. He can see Bob, the boss, too. He sees the senior leadership DL, and it's the same one. He sees two members. He sees Bob and Fred. Okay? So he has a slightly different view of the same DL than somebody else on the same system. What do you think Bob would see? All three members, right? Okay. I won't show you Bob because that's kind of insulting your intelligence. But okay, he would get to see all of the members of that DL. Now, what's kind of interesting is this. Well, let's say I try and, you know, because it's always interesting to see which DLs your boss is a member of. You know, your boss's boss. So I go look at Bob, and I see that he's a member of... Well, I can only see he's a member of two. He's in the All Fabricam DL, and he's in the senior leadership. He's actually in, well, several more. He's in a bunch of Contoso DLs, too. But I can't see that. And again, obviously, if I go look in the same senior leadership, my view of the gal is consistent based on my address book policy, not on the people that are within the gal. This also extends to things like, let's say I try and find Fred. I can't find Fred by typing in his alias. Doesn't mean I can't email him. Right? If I type in Fred at Fabricam and try and resolve it, it will tell me no match found, but it will just stay with an SMTP address. But let's say I decide I'm going to send an email to my boss complaining about Fred because I met this guy called Fred in the cafeteria. Come on, Owa. There we go. And I decide I'm going to send this, obviously, to the senior leadership DL. Because as far as I'm concerned, I've only got two members. Okay. And, you know, I can, just for the sake of argument here, I could just go and ask for a delivery receipt. Well, you can probably imagine what's going to happen, right? So Chris is going to have a bit of a fright. Do you want to use the mic if you have a question?
I was just going to ask.
You don't then? Okay. Right, go on. Absolutely. Right. So you can see that, yeah. So from an operational administration perspective, you know, if you want to span DLs across ABPs, that's the only time this becomes an issue. Okay? So you have to use this with a slight amount of, you know, of wariness. All right, so let's flick back here. I'll give you a few tips on how we're going to do this. So I need to move on a bit. So, hey, it's Exchange, right? Planning up front is always a great idea, and address book policies is no change for that. I'm going to plug on, and we'll get to some questions at the end. So here are some of the tips. Custom attributes. Now, custom attributes are really the most consistent way of scoping address lists. And the reason I say that, and you might want to use, well, there's a company and there's a department field, right? There is, but they don't exist on DLs. So you really can't create a list or an address list that just says all mail-enabled objects where company equals Fabricam, because if you do, you'll be missing the DLs out. So custom attributes are really the way to do this for the moment. Building simple filters and gathering them together is generally, you know, we've seen it's a lot easier than trying to build some humongous complex filter for sure. And this whole spanning DLs over address book policies, you know, it's kind of interesting, and I show it and show how it works, and you can see how it works, and it is kind of interesting to see how that could be used. But, you know, bear in mind as well, there's an additional load being placed on the CAS server, because every time you query for membership, we're having to do additional filtering. It's not a great load, and we're measuring that, so we're going to have some guidance around, you know, what kind of impact you might see, but it's not, you know, not something that is for free, right? Nothing's for free in this game. Build OABs on GALs, and we fixed it so it actually works. I actually entitled the bug, create OABs based on GALs and actually fix it this time. That was actually the name of the bug that I opened to track that particular item. And you need to make sure a user exists in their own GAL, because if they don't exist in their own GAL, weird things start to happen in OWA particularly, okay? Now, some other caveats, right? Here's the key one. If the client directly talks to AD, they're not going to be using address book policies. So Outlook Mac, which uses LDAP and talks directly to the domain controller, won't be subject to ABPs. They'll see every object in the directory. Now, there is a hope that we'll get there and add directory functionality more deeply into EWS, but we're not there at the moment. So that's definitely a big caveat you need to be aware of. Here's another one. If you multi-role CAS on a GC, then AD becomes the name server provider interface, right? Becomes NSPI, becomes the address book service. And therefore, we don't use our logic either. So you can't put the CAS role on a GC if you want this feature to work as well. The group management, the splitting the DL across multiple ABPs, also produces a problem in ECP. Because in ECP, it's kind of an interesting one. I discovered this one, and we're not going to get to fix this, I'm pretty sure, with an SP2, which is that when you try and do group management within ECP, if you try and add or join a group or something like that, then the list of groups returned to you are within the scope only of your ABP. However, if you then look at the members of the group, we show you the entire membership list, not members filtered by ABP. And that was because the code that sits behind that is running get group with members as an attribute being populated rather than running get distribution group, which would come through our way and blah, 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 blah. So if you do this whole DL cross ABP thing, then you're also going to need to turn off group management in ECP, or you risk exposing some membership as well. It's a corner case scenario. I don't want to dwell too much on that one because I think they're disparate orgs which have nothing to do with each other. It's not an issue for that. It's just in the one where you've got this joint CEO kind of environment. And don't try mixing all these things together, all right? ACLs and query-based ENs, because random stuff will happen, and it'll be random stuff that we didn't test. So it probably won't work. There is more. There's new features. Don't go running away yet. There's one more to come. Right, so if you have done the GAL segmentation ACL-based approach, you need to get from there to here, because it's always good and lovely in the new world, but you've got pain potentially to get there. So the way you would minimize the pain is basically this. You'd create a bunch of ABPs that kind of mirror the security groups and ACLs that you have in place now. So ABPs match ACLs. That's fairly straightforward. Then what you would do at the point of, you have to get Exchange 2010 installed first. And if you follow the GAL segmentation white paper, you won't be able to, because we need to be able to read the default GAL object and a whole bunch of stuff during initial setup. So there will be a period of downtime where you have to un-ACL, de-ACL, whatever the heck the right term would be, right? Change the ACLs so that you can change the default GAL object, get Exchange 2010 installed, and then you can make your changes back. So there's potentially a downtime there. As you move the mailboxes across, you would want to remove the query-based EN You can keep them in the security groups, fine, because the ABP applies to exactly the same groups, okay? And remove the OAB setting, although you could leave it and it wouldn't make any difference either, okay? But the key thing is this, test against your environment, because most people who've done a GAL segmentation following the white paper have slightly deviated from the path at some point. So it's important to test. So if you're here, how do you get from here to there? So the first one, this is the one I just mentioned. So if you've got the 2007 with ACL-based model now, we're going to produce some outline guidance to help you get to that environment. If you're in the bottom case, who's an HMC customer here? Anyone? The right direction for you is Exchange hosting mode. It is not Exchange with address book policies. Let me say this statement. Address book policies are not legal separation. We've seen different ways where a clever user, and I would put everyone in this room as the, you know, intelligent user who knows Exchange and could probably figure out how to do a LDP straight to AD or whatever it might be. Right, so there's no, this is not like tenanting as there is in the hosting mode of Exchange. This is more address book optimization for a user population. Okay, this is not legal separation. However, if you're in the middle bucket, which is you ignored our guidance and you decided to do an ACL-based GAL segmentation model with Exchange 2010, unfortunately, you know you're unsupported today, and we're not going to be producing guidance to get you from there to the new world. Doesn't mean you can't do it, but you're going to largely be doing that one on your own, I'm afraid. Okay. If you are a hoster, so if you are currently hosting, and you're thinking to yourself, "Oh, ABPs, I like the look of that. I'm going to start using these." Great, because the news that you'll be hopefully pleased to know is that we will support you now using the on-premises version of Exchange with SP2 and address book policies if you want to host. But you will already know of some of the caveats that you have to be aware of, and I've listed just a few here, which are things like the comment I've already made, legal separation. Here's a one that most people are not aware of. If you think about this from a pseudo hosting environment, if I assign default reviewer permissions to my calendar, well, default in the context of an ABP world means everybody. Okay, not just the guys in Fabricam or the guys in Contoso. It means default is everybody on the system. So you have things like that to remember as well. You also have the fact that, you know, if Chris and Fred as two separate organizations and they happen to email each other, they would get each other's internal OOF, not external OOF, because they are internal recipients. Right? So there are existing problems which many people who've done HMC or the 2007 ACL-based model have already experienced and probably already have ways around them. Just highlighting the fact that, you know, these ABPs are not the way to do hosting with on-premises Exchange. It's not the configure it and you're done kind of approach. And the bottom line is, if you really are a hoster, hosting mode Exchange is really the right platform for you. Okay? So, with about 15 minutes to go, let's do the last new feature. I'm hoping you'll like this one, right? OWA cross-site silent redirection. So, why do you want this feature? Oh, yes, you do. Oh, I've been, for 3 or 4 years, along with Ross, who's sitting down at the front, we've been campaigning to have this brought into the product. And it took a bit of work, and we're going to get there. So here's the scenario. Here's the scenario that we're solving. So if today you have two internet-facing AD sites, and you have mailboxes in both those sites, and a user using OWA connects to the wrong site, they try and log in. And OWA at that stage then has to make a decision, right? CAS at that stage has to make a decision. CAS will either proxy the connection to the other AD site, but only if forms-based auth has been disabled and integrated Windows auth has been enabled on the target CAS, or if there's an external URL populated over on that OWA virtual directory, he'll pop up a page which says, "You're in the wrong site, buddy. Click this link and go and try again." Okay? Now, that whole clicking the link, re-signing thing in again, I never liked that very much, right? You know, from a user perspective, it's not a great experience. Please log in twice. Now, I can always kind of buy the argument that if this were because you had a Europe organization, European office, data center, and a US one, for example, then it's probably common that the guys based in Europe use the Europe OWA URL, and their mailboxes are there, and they don't move much. And the same for the US. Well, that's kind of fine, and people can learn to use the right URL for their geographical location. What if these two data centers are now just 10 miles apart? They're two different AD sites, for one reason or another, but they're 10 miles apart. Then suddenly it becomes, one of the benefits of having them only 10 miles apart is you might want to move mailboxes around quite a lot. But if every time you move a mailbox, the user gets impacted by having to log into OWA twice, you're not going to be very popular with your users, okay? And so this is the point of the problem, or this is the problem that we were trying to solve. Now, in some scenarios, I'll talk about that in a second. Right, so here's the experience before. So I open up Outlook Web App, and I go to, in this case, redmond.fabricam.com. I'm old school, I stick with Fabricam. So I go to my redmondfabricam.com OWA site, and I log in. I type my credentials in. The next thing that happens is, because my mailbox isn't in that AD site, it got moved or whatever reason it might be, it's not in that AD site, it's somewhere else. The CAS server then gives me this page. It says, use the following link to open this mailbox with the best performance. And he puts a link up here which says london.fabricam.com. So I click on that link, and I then get another forms-based auth page, which is good. And so, which has the londonfabricam.com. So I then log in with my credentials for a second time. And then, assuming that all things are well, I get access to my mailbox. That's the experience today, right? Who likes that? Who thinks that's a terrific experience? Hope, right. Who would prefer this? I open up my browser. I go to redmond.fabricam.com. I type in the same user's credentials. I get access to my mailbox. It redirects me to london.fabricam.com. It redirects me and opens up my mailbox, and I haven't seen a thing. We're loving it. So this will be a single sign-on in a couple of scenarios. Right? The scenario is forms-based auth is enabled in both those sites, or integrated Windows auth will be enabled in both those sites. That would be the other time. If you had one with forms-based auth and one doing Windows integrated auth, you're not going to see the single sign-on experience. We kind of, because the legacy single sign-on redirect is based on forms-based auth and a form repost. So the form is an important part of this. Okay? Terrific. That's great. I like that. It's only taken 4 years. We're getting there. All right, so to wrap this up, and we can take a few questions in the last 10 minutes, we fixed a lot of bugs. Okay? Bugs are good. Bugs mean people are finding things. They're trying to do things with the software. So we find them, and hopefully we can fix them on a relatively quick period. Check the release notes. Whoever reads the release notes? You liars. Right, okay. Some of you do, right? To be fair, I never did, right? It's like, yeah. You hit the problem, and then you look at the release notes. That's generally not a good... You should probably try and reverse that order, because there will be things that we're going to put in the release notes that you might want to think about. Make sure it works in your environment. Now, all of these features look, some of them look great, but the ABP one in particular, there may be things in your environment that you need to factor into that. So they may add some complexity. The msexchangeteam.com blog, the product group blog, has changed locations, and this is the new location. There's going to be a blog post there tomorrow from RGM in Exchange on the subject of Service Pack 2. You have gotten to see screenshots that nobody else, or the demos there that nobody else has seen. This is the first time we've made any of this public. So tomorrow, the rest of the world gets to have a little look at some additional stuff. And Exchange still rocks. I think so. So with that, I'm all done. I'll say I hope that was beneficial. I'll click through the next through here. Oh.